All right, if you turn to Genesis 31. We'll be looking at the entire chapter. Hear the word of the Lord. Now Jacob heard that the sons of Laban were saying, "Jacob has taken all that was our father's, and from what was our father's, he has gained all his wealth." And Jacob saw that Laban did not regard him with favor as before. And then the Lord said to Jacob, "Return to the land of your fathers and to your kindred, and I will be with you." So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah into the field where his flock was and said to them, "I see that your father does not regard me with the favor as he did before, but the God of my father has been with me. You know how I have served your father with all my strength, yet your father has cheated me and changed my wages 10 times. But God did not permit him to harm me. If he said, 'The spotted shall be your wages,' then all the flock bore spotted. And if he said, 'The striped shall be your wages,' then all the flock bore striped. Thus God has taken away the livestock of your father and given them to me. In the breeding season of the flock, I lifted up my eyes and saw in a dream that the goats with that mated with the flock were striped, spotted, and mottled. Then the angel of God said to me in the dream, 'Jacob,' and I said, 'Here I am.' And he said, 'Lift up your eyes and see, all the goats that mate with the flock are striped, spotted, and mottled, for I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and made a vow to me. Now arise, go out from this land and return to the land of your kindred.' Then Rachel and Leah answered and said to him, 'Is there any portion or inheritance left for us in our father's house? Are we not regarded by him as foreigners? For he has sold us, and he has indeed devoured our money. All the wealth that God has taken away from our father belongs to us and to our children. Now then, whatever God has said to you, do.' So Jacob arose, set his sons and his wives on camels. He drove away all his livestock and all his property that he had gained, the livestock in his possession that he had acquired in Paddan Aram, to go to the land of Canaan to his father Isaac. Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel stole her father's household gods. And Jacob tricked Laban, the Aramean, by not telling him that he intended to flee. He fled with all he had and arose and crossed the Euphrates and set his face toward the hill country of Gilead. When it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled, he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him for 7 days and followed close after him into the hill country of Gilead. But God came to Laban, the Aramean, in a dream by night, and said to him, 'Be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad.' And Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the hill country, and Laban with his kinsmen pitched tents in the hill country of Gilead. And Laban said to Jacob, 'What have you done that you have tricked me and driven away my daughters like captives of the sword? Why did you flee secretly and trick me and did not tell me, so that I might have sent you away with myrrh and songs, with tambourine and lyre? And why did you not permit me to kiss my sons and my daughters farewell? Now you have done foolishly. It is in my power to do you harm, but the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, "Be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad." And now you have gone away because you longed greatly for your father's house. But why did you steal my gods?' Jacob answered and said to Laban, 'Because I was afraid, for I thought that you would take your daughters from me by force. Anyone with whom you find your gods shall not live. In the presence of our kinsmen, point out what I have that is yours and take it.' Now Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen. And so Laban went into Jacob's tent and into Leah's tent and into the tent of the two female servants, but he did not find them. And he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel's. Now Rachel had taken the household gods and put them in the camel's saddle and sat on them. Laban felt all about the tent, but did not find them. And she said to her father, "Oh, let not my lord be angry that I cannot rise before you, for the way of women is upon me." And so he searched, but he did not find the household gods. Then Jacob became angry and berated Laban. Jacob said to Laban, "What is my offense? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? For you have felt through all my goods. What have you found of all your household goods? Set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen that they may decide between us two. These 20 years I have been with you. Your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried, and I have not eaten the rams of your flocks or was torn by wild beasts. I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it myself. From my hands you required it, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. There I was, by day the heat consumed me, the cold by night, my sleep fled from my eyes. These 20 years I have been in your house. I served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flock, and you have changed my wages 10 times. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had not been on my side, surely you would have sent me away empty-handed. God saw my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night." Then Laban answered and said to Jacob, "The daughters are my daughters. The children are my children. The flocks are my flocks. And all you see is mine. But what can I do this day for my daughters or for the children whom they have borne? Come now, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me." So Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. And Jacob said to his kinsmen, gather stones. And they took stones and made a heap. And they ate there by the heap. Laban called it Jagar Sahadutha. But Jacob called it Gilead. Laban said, "This heap is a witness between you and me today." Therefore he named it Gilead and Mizpah. For he said, "The Lord watch between you and me when we are out of one another's sight. If you oppress my daughters or if you take wives besides my daughters, although no one is with us, see, God is witness between you and me." Then Laban said to Jacob, "See this heap and this pillar, which I have set between you and me. This heap is a witness, and the pillar is a witness, that I will not pass over this heap to you, and you will not pass over this heap and this pillar to me to do harm. The God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us." So Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac, and Jacob offered a sacrifice in the hill country and called his kinsmen to eat bread. They ate bread and spent the night in the hill country. Early in the next morning, Laban arose and kissed his grandchildren and his daughters and blessed them. Then Laban departed and returned home. Amen. Let's go. It's a tiring read. So Jacob realizes he's in a bad situation. I mean, he didn't even want to be in Laban's house in the first place. Remember last chapter, 6 years ago, he asked to leave. He said, "I want to go home." And Laban wouldn't let him. But now the circumstances are really starting to turn against Jacob, because Laban's sons jealously claim that basically Jacob has stolen all their father's wealth. And remember, to steal the father's wealth is to steal the son's wealth, not things you want to hear from your brothers-in-law. And when Jacob saw Laban, the Hebrew says literally, when Jacob saw Laban's face. So when he saw Laban, he knew, he could sense that Laban was not regarding him as he did before. And that really comes as no surprise. Laban is materialist. He's an opportunist. He loved Jacob as long as the Lord was blessing Laban through Jacob. But once that stopped and the blessing was just going to Jacob, and Laban wasn't too keen on Jacob anymore. And now the problem is that Jacob is sensing his vulnerability. I mean, what would you do if you were in the house, if you were under the authority of a man like Laban? But thankfully, in verse 3, God comes and brings clarity to the situation. He tells Jacob, you know, he does the thing that we all want to happen. We want God just to come in and tell us what to do, right? Well, he says, go home. It's time to leave. It says time to return to the promised land. And he promises to be with Jacob. And so what Jacob needs is protection. And that's exactly what he gets. That's the theme of this whole chapter, is God's protection of Jacob. In fact, it has been argued persuasively that the theme of Jacob's life is God protects his unworthy servant. That's the theme of Jacob's entire life. And God protects his covenant people. Now, we can forget that at times. And when we forget that God protects his covenant people, life gets skewed because we only view life through the lens of worldly circumstance. We view it through what we're experiencing or what we want to happen or don't want to happen. But we're invited by the scriptures tonight to see the world through the lens of God's protective providence. And that will make all the difference. The reality of God's protection gives us the right perspective on life. And we see that in verses 4 through 16. And specifically on the past as well as the present. And we see that in the conversation here between Jacob and his wives. And so Jacob calls his wives into the field so they can discuss in private what's going on. They need to have a little family meeting. And so in verses 4 through 9, Jacob enumerates to his wives the protection that he has received from God from Laban's schemes. He says, look, in verse 5, he says that, look, your dad doesn't regard me as he did before, but God has been with me. In verse 6, he says, your dad tried to cheat me, but God didn't permit it. Whatever Laban would try to, and what we find out here is that Laban was not keeping to the terms of his deal. He kept changing it. Because remember, all the spotted and striped were supposed to go to Jacob. But then once they were all doing spotted, he said, no, the striped are just yours. Then they all bore striped. And then, well, the spotted are yours. And then they all bore spotted. And then verse 9, he says, God has taken away Laban's livestock and given it to me. And so Jacob is giving all the credit to God, and now he's not making any mention of his breeding practices that we talked about, the peeled sticks and stuff, because he knows it wasn't him. It was God. He gives credit where credit is due. And that only God could have done that, especially since Laban kept changing his wages. And now 10 times could just be a figurative way, by the way, of saying he did it over and over and over again. It doesn't have to mean a literal 10 times. And then he also tells them about his dream, verses 10 through 13. And so what this dream does is what was true in his experience is confirmed in this vision that he has, which is an elaboration of what the summary that we see in verse 3. It says, the Lord said to Jacob, such and such. Well, this is what Jacob actually heard and saw and experienced. And the key point here in this dream is that God lets Jacob know that he is aware of what is happening to Jacob. He knows what Laban is doing to him. And he says, and I'm involved. I'm protecting you. I've been protecting you, and now it's time to go home. And so it gives a proper perspective as Jacob's looking on the past. He says, it wasn't my breeding practices. It wasn't my skillful negotiations. It wasn't any of that. It was God at work protecting me from Laban. So it gives a proper perspective on the past, but which also gives a proper perspective for the present. And we see this really in Leah and Rachel's responses in verses 4 to 16. Now, they respond in unison. Now, they didn't actually speak at the same time, verbatim. But it's just, this is their joint response together. And so the kind of a surprising unity between Leah and Rachel, considering what we just covered, right? And so either they stop bickering or they just found someone they like less than each other. Probably the second option. but they affirm that God has in fact been with Jacob and is responsible for, and that it is God who's been responsible for impoverishing Laban and enriching Jacob. And so, now in their eyes, this important note here, in their eyes, Laban is really just getting what he deserves since he acted dishonorably towards his daughters. Because you have to understand is that we talk about paying a bride price to the father in biblical times. The idea, though, was that it wasn't that the dad just hit the lottery. What it was, the way it would work is the suitor would pay the bride price. And what would happen was the family would spend or keep a portion of that bride price, but the bulk of that bride price would go back to the bride. It was a way to make sure that their daughters were provided for, that they weren't just going to marry their daughter off to a dirtbag, to a guy that just was like, oh yeah, I'll take care of her, don't you worry. He says, no. Let me see your checkbook, buddy. And not just let me see it, you've got to pay me the money. I've got to have the money. I've got to have the stuff, and then I'm going to give it back to you. But it was to prove that you could actually provide for your daughter. But what does it say? He squandered it all. He squandered it all. Now, again, Laban didn't get money, but he got 14 years of service from Jacob. And at that time, Laban spent it all. And basically what they say is, he sold us off like slave girls. He sold us off like commodities in the market. And let that just kind of resonate and just kind of impact us. There's all time to get into it between the importance of a father's relationship to his daughters. And what an awful relationship that must be when that's the relationship as well. We're just a commodity to our dad. He doesn't care about us. When we look back at our own lives, we need to see the hand of God's providence upon it. God protects His people. He restrains the evil around us. He does. It doesn't mean that we don't experience difficulty. Jacob himself has been treated basically as a slave for about 20 years. And God was completely fulfilling His promise of presence and protection in doing this. What it means is that as bad things may get, it is only the restraining providence of God that prevents them from being far worse. It is only the providence of God, the restraining providence of God, that keeps the world from being completely and absolutely evil. God is restraining the evil in this world. And He does protect His people, even though we still undergo suffering and painfulness and painful experiences. And even more, though, when we experience blessing, it's not because of our ingenuity or our craftiness or our willpower, but because God has blessed us. Jacob's a good shepherd. He's probably top of his class. But it's because God blessed him that he is rich. And so in difficulty and blessing, there is always humility and hope for the people of God. And knowing that God protects us gives us the courage to do what is necessary in the moment, even if it means running in the night from your dastardly father-in-law. And so that's what the reality of God's protection gives us perspective, but it also gives us confidence. Now, we're looking at the rest of the chapter here, verses 17 to 55, looking at Laban's pursuit of Jacob and the confrontation there. And so we get confidence when we understand that God is protecting us, and specifically in two areas. The first one is in conflict. The confidence in conflict. So 17 to 25 lays out the situation. And there's two key things going on. Jacob has obviously fled. He's taken all his stuff, he's taken his wives, and he's run. He picks the best time to run because he takes them during the sheep shearing time, which lasted several days, sometimes up to 12 days, required a lot of men. It was very busy. And if you remember at the end of last chapter, Laban had put a 3-day distance between his flocks and Jacob's. So Jacob already had a 3-day head start. That's why it takes Laban 10 days to catch up with him. And Rachel steals the household gods out of her dad's house, presumably as a good luck charm. And that's really the best understanding you can have of it. No surprise, she was raised in a pagan household, so it's not surprising that she still has some of that going on in her own life. She hasn't fully become a God-fearer, a worshiper of God alone. But there's an interesting wordplay in verse 19 and 20, because the text says at the end of verse 19 that Rachel stole Laban's gods. But verse 20 says Jacob stole Laban's heart. And that's what the text actually says. It says it tricked, usually what it says in the English, he tricked or fooled or deceived Laban. But actually the Hebrew says he stole Laban's heart. Rachel stole his gods, Jacob stole Laban's heart. And that's not a good thing. I'm just saying it's not a good term, it's not a friendly term. We think, oh, you stole my heart as in a romantic. That's not what Moses is getting at here. Laban's heart is in Jacob's possessions. And so Jacob has taken and run off. And as you found out, remember at the end, Laban says, everything's mine. And so his heart is in his possessions, and Jacob took off his possessions. Took off with what Laban calls his own possessions. And he doesn't do that justly, by the way. And so Jacob's fleeing. Laban is pursuing, but God restrains him. God intervenes and he says, don't you threaten him. That's what that actually means. You kind of wonder. He says, well, don't say anything to him, good or bad. Well, Laban says quite a bit, we find out, but he doesn't threaten him. He says, don't threaten him. And that means don't do him harm. If you can't even threaten somebody, you certainly can't hurt them. So God intervenes, tells him, hey, you cannot hurt him. But in verse 25 really kind of paints this kind of military battle picture, because this is military language. Laban overtakes Jacob. There's that language comes up again numerous times. Famous one is where David's men overtake the men who had ransacked their wives and their children, and all it says they overtook them. And so you have this, and then also the idea of pitching tents. Jacob and his crew pitch their tent. It's like one army pitched their tents, another army pitched their tents, and the battle's about to ensue. And that's kind of the picture here, is of two opposing sides. And we hear, and we see the battle of words begin in verse 26 with Laban's complaint. He says two things. He says basically in verses 26 to 29, you deceived me. You tricked me. You took my daughters and you took my stuff. Yeah, and basically says you're a thief and you're a mercenary. You're like a soldier. You took my daughters off like, and notice he doesn't say you took your wives. He said you took my daughters off like they're prisoners of war, like the soldiers do when they ransack a village and they take the women. So that's what you did. And then he kind of asks a perplexing question, but also an accusation. You took my gods. Why'd you take my gods? And we're going to look at that more in depth in a little bit. But this seems to be a very serious charge. And if Jacob is found guilty, it's uncertain what would happen. Now, it seems to be a very serious charge, because Jacob, he throws out capital punishment as the offense. And you know Rachel's got to go. There's got to be a gulp in Rachel's throat, since she's the one who stole it. And obviously Jacob doesn't know. And Jacob's so certain of his own innocence, he's going, no way I stole him. No way anybody in my, no one in my household would do that. Right? But the thing is if Laban finds his household gods, would he then lay a claim to everything because Jacob's then a thief? Several commentators noted that they would say Laban could, by rights, take Jacob as an indentured servant or kind of prisoner and take everything back. So there's high stakes. And I think it makes sense, especially as you notice there's the author kind of messing with us as he's going through and has Laban detailing the search of each tent and kind of heightening the tension here. And Jacob makes his initial response, though, and notice he's very honest. He says, yeah, I ran. And I ran because I was concerned about you. Now, I do think that Jacob's a little more honest here, because Laban has revealed that God has intervened and said, he says, look, I could hurt you, but your God came to me and says, I can't. And so Jacob, I think, feels a little more free to say, hey, well, yeah, I ran from you because I thought you were going to take your daughters from me by force. I thought you were going to do harm to me, and so I ran. Then Laban searches, verses 33 to 35. Now notice, he goes to Jacob's tent first. Who does he suspect? He goes to Jacob's tent first, and then the tension's building, especially as we get to Rachel's tent, because it's not till after the narrator says he goes into Rachel's tent, who stole the gods. It's in the next verse that he goes, oh, but don't worry, she's sitting on him on the camel. And Laban's search turns up empty, and so he's made to look like a fool. And that's when Jacob, he says, okay, it's go time. And he jumped and he says, now he's found in the right, now he's been exonerated in the eyes of all the relatives. He says, he basically unloads what obviously has been brooding in Jacob for a long time. In fact, actually, if you read this text, it actually reads, the first part of Jacob's speech actually reads like a poem. Some commentators claim that it is a poem, for a portion of it anyway. But then it kind of trails off into more normal speech. Here's my speculative thought. You know how you have that speech ready? It's somebody you've been wanting to talk to for a while. You've got a grief and you've been rolling that thing over, and you know, you wax poetic, you're making allusions, you know, you're doing things and you're coming off, I mean, you're Socrates, you know, in your own mind, when you're coming off with your, with this rhetoric coming out. And so he goes, and I think that's what begins here is he goes, and he eventually switches off of that. But Jacob lines out the end speculation. Jacob lines out how hard he worked, the difficult conditions that he worked in, and he calls for Laban's kinsmen and his own kinsmen to judge between them. He says, hey, let's make this fair. Let's just have everyone hear the evidence and find out who's right. Now, we'll say, when you're talking about a dispute, things like that, I mean, that's what you want to deal with. You want to deal with the facts, and you also want to invite transparency. You want to invite a third party to come in and to judge between times. That's practical advice. That's free. But then he makes a key point here. He says, look, if it wasn't for God, Laban would have sent him away empty-handed. And you know that's true. Knowing what we know about Laban, if he could have used Jacob up for 20 years and sent him off and kept his daughters and kept all the stuff, he would have done it. But God protected him, and he confronts Laban with that very fact. It was the God of Abraham, the terror of Isaac, that protected Jacob then and even now. Now, the terror of Isaac, the fear of Isaac, some people have tried to twist that into a more positive, happy-sounding word. But really, it's just a proper reference for the fact that the sovereign God inspires dread in his enemies and the enemies of his people. But also note that it's important when we're in conflict, that when we are in conflict, that our past conduct matters. It improves Jacob's case that he has an impeccable record. And notice, Jacob didn't even bring up the whole daughter swap thing at the beginning. He didn't say, we're not even going to bring that up. But at the end of the day, we all have to give credit to God who protects us, even in the moment, even in conflict. And to know that when we're in conflict with someone, it is God who's going to protect us ultimately. It's not our wiles and our negotiative abilities or our ability to twist people and turn them and make them do what we want. The protection of God gives us confidence in conflict. It also gives us confidence for the future. We look at verses 43 through 55. And so Laban essentially ignores the whole speech that Jacob gives. And because he insists that everything belongs to him. You know, it's that mine. Now, while this seems like a very bold claim, at the end of the day, Laban's just saving face. It's what he's really doing. And it's revealed by what he does next. He says, everything's mine, but let's make a covenant and I'm going to give it all to you anyway.
The person who, generally speaking, in human terms, the human person who requests a covenant with someone else is the inferior party. Laban is now acknowledging that Jacob is at least a peer. He's at least an equal with him now. And so now he's saying, I want you to make a deal. Just like Abimelech asked for a covenant with Abraham. And remember, Abimelech Jr. asked for one with Isaac. And so they go through the ceremony. They establish boundary markers that they can't cross, you know, in a military fashion. Now, interestingly, I thought it was really interesting and very hypocritical for Laban. He tells Jacob, he says, don't mistreat my daughters and don't take extra wives. You can't take it. Now, if I remember right, was it not Laban who mistreated his daughters? And wasn't he the one that forced Jacob to commit bigamy in the first place? And just kind of like, you know, it's the do as I say, not as I do. Or as one commentator said, do as I say, not as I did. It's Laban who needs his covenant because Jacob belongs to God. Jacob doesn't need the covenant. He doesn't want to go back to Laban's house. He said, I'm not coming back there. I'm going to the promised land. I'm going to the land of my fathers. It's Laban who wants it because he knows Jacob is on the rise because he belongs to God. And we as God's people, we belong to God. There's nothing but blessing that awaits us. Even if we don't have people crashing down our door to make covenants with us, we can be confident for the future because like Jacob, and even like Israel after him, God is bringing his covenant people into the promised land. Finally, we can have confidence because Yahweh is the one true God. This is possibly one of the most important points I'm going to make tonight. If you've missed it all, shame on you. No, just kidding. Now, if you've missed it all, just listen to this. Because there's a very humorous but very serious statement being made, especially since verse 19. Whenever the Bible gets funny, whenever the Bible gets sarcastic and we laugh, we need to understand that the Bible uses sarcasm and humor to communicate a very grave reality. Something very, very serious that we need to take into account. Notice also that when Laban went to make the covenant, he called on multiple gods. I'm not too happy with the ESV because I don't think they quite illustrate it. He calls on the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, but it really should be translated the God of Abraham and the gods of Nahor. Because remember, Laban's a pagan. He's a polytheist. He's got household gods. And so he's calling on the gods. But what does Jacob swear by? The fear, the terror of Isaac. The narrator has been all too happy to subtly and not so subtly make the point that there is only one true God. Because what did Rachel do in verse 19? She stole Laban's gods. Now, in the Hebrew mindset, they'd be asking, I wasn't aware that gods could be stolen. Oh, are your gods subject to godnapping? I didn't know that they could do that. That that could happen to a god. And even more, Laban's got to go search for them. He's got to go find them. They're helpless until Laban finds them. He's got to go and retrieve these gods. And what I think would have surely sent the Hebrew audience into uproarious laughter, or at least giggles, was this picture of Rachel sitting on the gods and claiming that she was menstruating. I mean, essentially, Laban's household gods became a sanitary napkin. I mean, that is what Moses is doing there in that portrayal. That's what's happening. Pagan gods are stolen, they're hidden and defiled because they can do absolutely nothing because they cannot see, nor hear, nor speak. But what does Yahweh do? You know, there's a similar situation. There's a parallel to this in the book of in the book of 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel 4, chapters 4 through 6. Israel's been disobedient to the Lord, but they say, hey, we're going to go fight the Philistines, and they go get beat. And they say, hey, I got a great idea. Let's bring the Ark of the Covenant. The place where God's, you know, special presence. Let's bring that because no one can beat us there, and we'll get victory because we bring, he's our lucky rabbit's foot. This is our good luck charm. So they go and they get beat, and the Philistines take the ark, and they take it and they put it in the temple of their god Dagon, and Dagon, who has triumphed over Yahweh, and then they go into the temple and Dagon's fallen over before the altar. It's as if Dagon's worshiping. He's bowing before the altar. And so they go, oh no, pick Dagon back up, put him back up top, and they go back in later. He's fallen over, except this time his hands and his head is broken off. And so, and they say, okay, we got to get this out of here because it says that Yahweh is being hard on us and hard on Dagon. He's being hard on our God. And so we need to get out of here. So what do? They take the ark, they put it on a cart, they put a bunch of gold, a gold guilt offering, they hook it to two oxen, and it makes its way on its own back to Israel. And one of the really interesting things is the oxen are lowing all the way, which means they don't want to go the direction, but that means the divine hand is moving. The point is, God says, I don't need nobody to come get me. I can take care of myself. Thank you very much. Yahweh doesn't need anyone. He is not a good luck charm. He intervenes. He protects His covenant people. He saves His covenant people. He sends His only Son to die on a cross to save His people. And even now, we're protected so that even death has no claim on us. We may die once in the flesh, but we will never die eternally. And so God protects His covenant people. He protected Jacob. He protected Israel and brought them out of Egypt. He protects us and will bring us into the land that He has promised us. And because God protects His people, that means we can confidently carry out His will in the present. Let's pray.